Without further ado, I would like to introduce Duane. He's going to talk about his new book and some of his research findings on the nuclear revival, as he calls it, and then some of the things that are happening in Saskatchewan right now, which is in a new era, I think he would describe it, in terms of its approach to the nuclear industry. So without any further ado, Duane.
Thanks, Ken. So Ken is right. The first three quarters of what I'm going to talk about is from the Saskatchewan chapter of my book, which came out in December of 2012. I still see it as new, even though it's been out for about 2 years now. The last quarter is about events since December of 2012, or really events since the summer of 2012. And so that's my plan today. I'm glad to be in Regina. I've spent a lot of time over the last several years coming to Saskatchewan, both researching on this book and doing other events, and I was pleased to be able to come out for Joe's defense, and they said, well, while you're here, can you do something else? And so this is my something else. I want to begin really with the Uranium Development Partnership, and I think that's really where it starts. So the Wall government is elected in 2007, and they formed this commission in November of 2008 to make recommendations to the government on really increasing opportunities in the uranium industry in a number of different ways. So more exploration and mining, which were already existing, but they wanted to go further than that. But those last four items, conversion, enrichment, fuel manufacturing, nuclear reactors for electricity, those were all new. That he wanted, instead of just shipping the uranium out of the province. It was chaired by Richard Florizen, and he got into a lot of controversy in chairing this panel, so he's in more controversy now at Dalhousie, so he's well equipped to dealing with this. This was designed to be an industry consultation and an industry-driven program. And so Duncan Hawthorne from Bruce Power, Jerry Grandy, then CEO of Cameco, Armand Laferriere, who was at that time CEO of Areva Canada, those were all on the commission. And so this was the plan right from the get-go. They released the report in March of 2009 and identified a number of priorities. The one that I'm going to focus on this afternoon is nuclear power generation. So what drove this? Well, I think there's a number of drivers that extended to the Uranium Development Partnership, and those are increasing electricity demand in Saskatchewan, the effects of climate change, increasing uranium value added, and political support, and I'll talk about that political support. So on the electricity demand, there were a number of different studies that Bruce Power and SaskPower put together on the need for new electricity in the province because demand has been risen. And the demand was rising because of population growth. I know it's still rare to be talking about population growth in Saskatchewan, but in the last 8 years, 9 years, there has been population growth. We see that with, I remember after Wall took office, he took out billboards in Calgary advising people to go home. Return home to Saskatchewan, and many of them took up that offer, as well as economic activity. So in both of those is what drives electricity demand, but also replacing old systems of electricity. Second driver, climate change. Over 60% of electricity in Saskatchewan currently comes from coal and natural gas. Here's a quote from SaskPower: with new environmental regulations, imminent reliance on conventional coal-fired generation is unlikely to be feasible. And so dealing with climate change, we can see illustrations outside the nuclear field, like the carbon capture project at Boundary Dam, but others as well. Saskatchewan is a major fossil fuel producer. It trails Ontario, Quebec, and Alberta in total emissions and has the highest emission per capita in the country. and has the highest growth rate in Canada, 4 times the national average, higher than Alberta. Alberta is often seen as being, you know, the laggard in Confederation. It's the international target, but in fact, Saskatchewan's per capita emissions are higher than Alberta. And that's, so that is one of the drivers for climate change. Bruce Power made the argument that a 1,000-megawatt reactor would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 1.7 megatons annually. Third driver is uranium value added, to leverage uranium reserves. I was at a conference in Ottawa where Brad Wall spoke, and one of his quotes was, "The next ounce of yellow cake that we add any value to at all will be the first." And I don't think he just said that in Ontario. I think he was saying that right across the province and the country. And really, that was the purpose of why he created the UDP, was how to leverage that uranium and do more with it. That leads to political support. I don't think I would be out of step to refer to Brad Wall as the most nuclear-friendly politician in Canada. It's a pretty short contest. It was his vision around the UDP. He did some other things. He promoted this idea of a Canadian neutron center. So just to put this in context, the current major research reactor in Ottawa, Chalk River, the NRU, was built in the late 1950s. It's had periodic problems over the last decade. This has affected medical isotope production as well as research capacity. And so the government of Canada put out a call to say, what should we do to replace the NRU? And Saskatchewan put forward the most comprehensive proposal, which was simply to replicate that size of research reactor in Saskatchewan. It was also the most expensive of the proposals. And which is why, when it came to the government of Canada, they rejected that proposal. They have decided instead to rely on cyclotrons to produce medical isotopes around the country instead of at a central location in the NRU. They do not yet have a plan of what to do with the research capacity at the NRU, although I will note they had originally planned to shut down the NRU in 2016, and about a month ago, Gary Rickford announced that no, they're going to delay that a bit more. And they're going to delay that because they have no replacement in mind. And while the focus in the public's mind was around isotope production, that's only about 10% of what the NRU did. And most of the rest dealt with materials research, not just in the nuclear field, but they were using it in the automotive sector, they were using it for NASA, they were using it for all sorts of pure research. And the scientific community in Canada has been saying, we simply can't live without something like that. And it was Saskatchewan that was first put a major proposal on the table. Now, to be fair, when they put out the funding mechanism, they expected the feds to pay for most of it. But that's fine. That's what they're doing in Ottawa anyway. So also, he promised around this time a $30 million commitment to what would eventually become the Fedoric Center. And I'm going to talk a bit about the Fedoric Center in a moment. And in his various speeches during this time period of 2009-2010, he said he wanted to replace coal plants with small nuclear facilities. Now, you'll notice when I talked about Bruce Power, in this time period, Bruce Power was talking about a 1,000-megawatt reactor. Small is anywhere from 50 to 300 megawatts. And I'm going to return to the small idea because it's really critical to this discussion. Beyond Brad Wall, though, I think we need to walk through political support. And I would suggest that there's been 60 years of largely all-party support in this province. In the 1940s and 50s, it was the CCF who initiated uranium mining. In the 1960s, the Liberals were in power. They established the Rabbit Lake Mine. In the 70s and 80s, the NDP created the Saskatchewan Mining Development Corp, which would eventually become privatized and be known as Cameco. They approved new uranium mines, and they supported the Warman Refinery, although at the end, the Warman Refinery was never built. It was moved to Deep River. The Progressive Conservatives were in power in the 1980s. They pursued a CANDU 3. CANDU 3 would have been about 300 megawatts. So in one sense, the idea of introducing a small nuclear reactor for this province did not emerge under the Uranium Development Partnership. The idea is actually much older than that and goes back to the 1980s. When the Romanoke government came in 1991, they did three things almost immediately. One is they ditched the CANDU 3 idea. Part of that was around electricity demand and around a nuclear reactor, but the others were just around the expense. So you have to think back to what the economic situation was like in the early 90s in this province. The second thing they did is they reversed their party position on no new mines. That no new mines policy was adopted in 1981 after they lost power. When they returned to power in 1991, they had a very large convention in Romanoke push through the replacement of that no new mines policy, and they opened up five new uranium mines. They also sought out value-added production. So in a sense, what the Wall government was doing in 2008 and 2009 was continuing stuff of what Lauren Calvert was doing in the later years of his government. So while this has been a very partisan issue, my point here is it may be partisan, but the government of the day tends to be much more supportive than when that same party is in opposition. Okay. So, you got the Wall government, you've got all these drivers, you released this report, and then they decided to do a public consultation process on it. And this is the public process. Okay. They appointed Dan Perrins, who had been chief of staff of a previous NDP premier, had been head of the public sector, and he was to head the public consultation process. It occurred in the spring and summer of 2009, and they did it through a number of ways. They did it through a stakeholder conference, they did it with oral and written submissions, but most importantly, they did public hearings right across the province, and here's an ad for the one in Saskatoon in June. There are special opportunities for First Nations and Métis people to participate in the process. They developed a website. 2,600 people attended those public hearings. 1,300 letter and email responses. So a lot of people participated. It was major news coverage. I actually have an article coming out in an academic journal in the spring comparing the public consultation process in Saskatchewan and Alberta, and they were very different. Alberta did not have, for example, public hearings. It was not front page news or lead story on the TV in Alberta as it was in Saskatchewan. The anti-nuclear movement mobilized strongly against the UDP. Clean Green Saskatchewan, the Saskatchewan Environmental Society, the Saskatchewan Union of Nurses, all participated in these hearings and participated vocally in these hearings. And so what was driving their opposition to the UDP? Well, here's a brief breakdown of some of the major policy beliefs that members of the anti-nuclear coalition, I call it, believed in. They believed that they're unsafe and they focused on Chernobyl. They didn't mention Fukushima because that occurs later, and I am going to talk about the impact of the Fukushima accident. They say that the entire fuel cycle, right from uranium mining at the beginning to waste disposal at the end, creates radiation, which causes cancer. They point out that reactors produce nuclear waste that lasts for hundreds of thousands of years. They argue that instead of climate change being a driver for nuclear energy, that nuclear energy, in fact, should not be seen to mitigate climate change. And they make that case in a couple ways. They say, first, if you look at life cycle emissions, that there are emissions created at the uranium mining level. There are enrichment issues that create greenhouse gas emissions. And so right through the fuel cycle, there are emissions. And second, instead of using money on nuclear energy, it should be devoted to conservation, electricity conservation, and renewable energy sources, geothermal, wind, solar. They make the argument that there's a clear link between civilian nuclear energy and military nuclear bombs, and I showed a copy of Jim Harding's book, and it's called Canada's Deadly Secret. And much of it is about the role of Saskatchewan uranium in nuclear weapons production around the world. And their final belief is that nuclear energy is uneconomical and is heavily subsidized by the government, whether that is the federal government or a provincial government. So, let's go back to the public consultation. The future of uranium, which was the report that Perrins wrote based on the feedback he received, was released in the fall of 2009. But Perrins was under a very strict mandate. He was simply to summarize feedback. He was not to analyze feedback, he was to summarize it. He was not to take on an advocacy role for either pro-nuclear development or anti-nuclear development. And these are the statistics that come out of that report. Of those submitting oral presentations, of those submitting written presentations, 85% of the people who did so were opposed to nuclear power generation. 70% were opposed to uranium upgrading, 86% opposition to nuclear waste and storage, and down the list you go. The only thing that did not get massive negative support was nuclear research and development. I don't think I've got it in here. I do in my book. There was also support for medical isotopes, but it was not as high as you would imagine. Instead, they were arguing for isotope production that didn't involve nuclear fission, such as through a cyclotron. So Perrins just gave the raw data, what happened. So I was not hamstrung, so I will provide some analysis of what transpired. It was not a statistically representative sample of public opinion, and I'll just give one illustration. Bruce Power gave one submission. That counted as one submission. It didn't matter how many employees were participating or the size of the industry, it counted as one. Joe Blank could give a presentation in Moose Jaw, he also counted as one. Joe could give a presentation in Regina, that would also count as one. So Joe would now be at two presentations to Bruce Power. The second thing is it wasn't a statistical sample like public opinion polling is of the province. It was only who showed up. Nevertheless, it did illustrate a wide range of opposition. Environmental groups, labor unions, peace groups, religious groups. There was a geographic scope right across the province from the hearings that they had from Prince Albert to Swift Current. There was a range of arguments that they raised in opposition. There were economic arguments, there were health arguments, there were safety arguments, there were environmental arguments, and there were peace arguments. Opponents participated more than supporters. So you could say, well, where were the supporters? Well, maybe they didn't feel as strongly about this as the opponents do. So that may suggest that even if public opinion polling, which shows a majority of support of nuclear energy in Saskatchewan, are not as passionate about that as the minority group is. And that's something that governments need to take into account. Not just what is your support, but what is the level of support. And clearly the opponents were much higher in intensity. All right, so you've had the UDP report, you've had the public consultation. What does the government do now with this? Well, in December of 2009, one of the outcomes was they directed SaskPower to continue including nuclear power in the range of energy options available for additional baseload generation capacity in the medium and long term after 2020. Is that supporting nuclear energy or is that opposing nuclear energy? It was a very nice statement because it was both. You could read it in both of those ways. I mean, if you're sitting in 2009, 2020 is a long ways away. You know, governments could change, political attitudes could change. So the anti-nuclear people saw this as a victory. The pro-nuclear people also saw this as a victory because they know how long it takes to build and license and operate a reactor that it could take 10 years to do. So this was actually a really ingenious way for the government to say, you're both right. Okay. So we need to look at events past December 2009. I will take the view here that they're much more supportive of nuclear energy as the UDP was than the public consultation was, and that this was a message for that. So how can we reconcile it? Well, one argument could be that the Wall government is, and this is a quote from one of the groups that participated in the public consultation process, they called the Wall government massively pro-uranium and pro-development. I would suggest that the Wall government delayed the reactor decision much more so based on cost issues than other factors. So it was less about the public consultation than it was dollars and cents. We also need to look at the gap between Wall's vision and public concern over nuclear energy. And I believe the Wall government believed the public consultation was flawed. 85% of responders were opposed to nuclear energy, not 85% of Saskatchewanians. Perrin said himself that there was no statistical reliability in those who presented. The government showed that independent polling has shown support for nuclear industry, and there was a variety of methodological problems, from coding to the factual accuracy of responses that Perrins didn't investigate because he couldn't, but the Wall government did. I think an additional point is that policymakers have to somehow balance expertise with democracy. So for example, we do not have a vote or a referendum on whether gravity exists. All right? When it comes to science, there are facts and there are non-facts. But we're not dealing so much with science here, we're dealing with political science in one sense, which is not quite the same thing. And so how do you balance democracy and expertise is a tough thing that governments have to deal with. And we're seeing it not just in this realm, but in climate change, in evolution, in vaccination, you name the debate, and how do you respond with those? My reading of the situation is the Wall government accepted arguments from nuclear scientists, those with PhDs in chemistry or physics. They probably ignored the political science PhDs. From both the academy and industry, and discounted public opinion a bit more. And the reason I say that is we need to go beyond the December 2009 decision. It was followed up by other pro-nuclear announcements. So January of 2011, in a major address, Wall announces a clear nuclear agenda for Saskatchewan, focusing on nuclear medicine, which was supportive in both the UDP and in the public consultation process, nuclear research and development, which was also supported in both the UDP and the public consultation process, and small reactors for electricity. Now, at the time, he was referring to reactors smaller than 500 megawatts, but the common nomenclature in the industry is small is between 50 and 300. So the first two items, I think, he had public support on. The third one, that's going to depend on your reading of that, but to go from instead of 1,000 megawatts to small. Small sounds better. But there's also reasons for small that deal with the size of the grid in Saskatchewan and the possibility of cost issues. And so at the end of today's presentation, I'm going to talk a lot more about small reactors. So this is in January of 2011. 2 months later, we have the Fukushima nuclear accident. So there's an example. This is where you can see Fukushima is along the northeast coast, far away, 150 kilometers from Tokyo. Japan, the islands of Japan, it's a small country. So on the map, it looks like it's a fair distance, but it's closer than Saskatoon is to Regina. It was a 9.0 earthquake, a massive tsunami, and a loss of electricity. It was a triple disaster that killed 25,000 people. Not the nuclear disaster didn't kill 25,000 people. The earthquake and the tsunami did. So when the earthquake hit, the reactor operated the way reactors should. It shut itself down. The problem was the tsunami. The tsunami went over the walls that they had produced, and it hit the generators. Unfortunately, the generators were in the basement of the building, and so they were contaminated with water, so the generators kicked out and were useless. So there was a loss of electricity. This is where the problem lies. It's not the fact it was hit by an earthquake, it's not the fact it hit by a tsunami, it was the loss of electricity. Because imagine you're driving a car and you turn the car off, okay? Turn the engine off. Is the engine still hot? I'm asking. Yes, yes it is. Okay. Well, imagine a reactor, okay, and how hot that is. So to cool it, you need to keep funneling water through to cool down the reactor core. The reactor will be getting cooler just by natural fission process, but it's still extremely hot. So you need water. Well, you need to pump that water through because you don't have access to the reactor core. It is in a containment dome of 10 feet of concrete and steel. So you have these pump systems that put the water through the reactor core. Okay. Problem is the pumps operate on electricity. You don't have electricity. So you have a problem with the loss of coolant. There were all sorts of issues that occurred, but eventually the situation was contained. I will say, okay, and this is not controversial, this is based on stuff that's come out of the World Health Organization, the International Atomic Energy Agency, who have all been doing studies on this. One person died because of the reactor accident, and it was someone on a crane who got knocked off his crane when the earthquake hit. The 25,000 people that died were due to the earthquake, to the tsunami, and to the evacuation. More people died being evacuated from Fukushima than died because of the reactor accident, mainly elderly people. And so that's where the 25,000 dead comes from. Okay. All right, so what was the political impact of Japan's nuclear crisis after all this happened on the other side of the world? It affirmed its nuclear agenda. So this was a quote by Rob Norris right after the accident occurred, said that SaskPower has an ethical obligation to move forward with uranium mining. And to develop a triple P, public-private partnership for small, that should be reactors, not rectors, in Saskatchewan. That's a misprint. Okay. So, I don't think the Fukushima accident has really shifted the debate in Saskatchewan. I think the Three Mile Island accident, which also had no deaths, and Chernobyl, which was much more dangerous, had a greater impact than what Fukushima has had. So what have been the post-Fukushima developments since 2011, since 2012? I would say there's three that relate to the nuclear energy agenda in this province. The first was the establishment of the Fedoric Center. The second is the role of SaskPower investigating the use of small modular reactors. And the third, and this is my idea, is the use of small modular reactors at the uranium mines in northern Saskatchewan. So what can we say about the Fedoric Center? I will say, first of all, before I get to that, just a note. The Fedoric Center requires the principal investigators all to be from the province of Saskatchewan, although they encourage partnerships from people outside of Saskatchewan. But those people who have to vet the projects, what is called the Project Advisory Committee, have to be from people, academics, outside of Saskatchewan, and I am on the Project Advisory Committee of the Fedoric Center because I'm based in Calgary at Mount Royal University. The other two people are based at McMaster University in Hamilton and the University of Western Ontario in London. So just I wanted to put that out there. The Fedoric Center, the Sylvia Fedoric Canadian Center for Nuclear Innovation, it is called the Canadian Center. It's much more of a Saskatchewan center, but they like the term Canadian. Established formally in 2011, the Saskatchewan government has made a $30 million commitment over 7 years to fund it. The goal is to place Saskatchewan among the global leaders in nuclear research and development, training through investment and partnerships with the academy and industry for maximum societal and economic benefit. And they do that in a couple of different ways. One is project funding. And that's where I play a small role in four areas: nuclear medicine, nuclear materials, nuclear energy, and the physical and social environment. So some of the projects that we have funded involve better radiation detectors that you can use with a smartphone, stuff around better imaging, nuclear imaging for diabetes research. The science behind it is quite complex, so the way that I narrow it down is the traditional method was going into a hospital for 16 hours and receiving a needle every half hour for those 16 hours. They have reduced that to 4 hours and 3 needles. I can't speak to the science, that's well beyond my knowledge of high school chemistry, but I can understand how many times you have to be poked in the arm with a needle, and this is an improvement. On the physical environment, we funded a project to look at emissions coming out of the uranium mines. And the other thing we've looked at is social, and so there's been some extensive public opinion research that Lolien Bourdel, for example, from the University of Saskatchewan, has done on the social environment. So four categories: materials, energy, physical and social environment, and nuclear medicine. It's also encouraging collaboration. So each of these projects involve partnerships with scientists or laboratories outside of Saskatchewan. So for example, the Chalk River Laboratories in Ontario or the Idaho National Laboratories have been collaborators, as well as the business sector and various private sector companies have been involved in there. And the third is they now have some physical infrastructure. There is a new cyclotron that was built in Saskatoon that is going to be used for research purposes, but also to develop specific types of medical isotopes. This is a picture of the cyclotron there. Okay. So a world-class center for research, training, innovation, nuclear medicine, radiochemistry, physics, and the development of new radiopharmaceuticals for medical imaging. So what the Fedoric Center is doing is developing and creating and enhancing capacity in a wide variety of fields throughout this province and scientific fields and being supported by the government. The second development has been the investigation by SaskPower of small modular reactors. And here's a more recent quote from the current CEO, Robert Watson, talking about the size of the Saskatchewan grid. You don't want a situation where you have a very large power plant that would represent 20% or 15% or 25% of electricity in a province. That could be a problem if it ever gets shut down for repairs or maintenance or what have you. And a good example of that is the Point Lepreau reactor in New Brunswick represents a third of electricity in that province. What that meant was when they shut it offline to do a refurbishment project, they had to import 33% of their electricity because they didn't have that capacity. So you don't want any single plant to represent that. In the case of Ontario electricity, about 60% of Ontario electricity comes from nuclear, but not from one plant, from 20 different reactors in different locations. There's a couple issues. One is you don't want to be dependent on one plant. The second is the size of the grid. But smaller reactors are being developed, and there's a lot of R&D going around the world on smaller reactors. And this is not new technology. Aircraft carriers have small nuclear reactors running them. Same thing with nuclear submarines. I don't mean nuclear weapons on a submarine. I mean a nuclear-powered submarine that allows a sub to go under the Arctic Ocean and go underwater for months at a time that a diesel-generating submarine could not do. These were all developed in the 1950s. The problem is the Soviet defense system was not particularly interested in cost issues. The U.S. Defense Department, not particularly interested in cost issues. So it's how to take that old technology and make it cost effective for a civilian purposes. The other advantage of these reactors is in more remote locations where you have to truck in diesel fuel, which leads me to my idea about putting them in the uranium mines. Okay, sort of cradle-to-grave idea of the nuclear fuel cycle. You can see how remote those mines are from the southern part of the province. And currently, to operate those plants, which require electricity to mine it out, as well as all the ancillary services, they have to truck in diesel fuel, which is both expensive. Diesel fuel is very volatile. The emissions are quite high. And so I think this would be a great idea to put them in the actual uranium mine. And there would be a lot of different benefits. Reduce the cost of fuel, lessen the emissions from mining, but also a better way of electrifying northern Saskatchewan and allowing for a greater diversification of northern Saskatchewan's economy. We do know that electrification has had great economic developments, both in the developed and the developing world. We can see it with the Tennessee Valley Authority in the 1930s, electrifying rural U.S. We can see it with the rural electrification policies of Saskatchewan in the 1940s. We can see this in China and India today. The best way of getting people out of poverty is through electricity. And so northern Saskatchewan, by putting a small reactor there, would be a better, cheaper way of electrifying the region. But there are challenges of these small modular reactors, even though, as I said, the technology itself is not particularly new. The first challenge is regulation and licensing. So, for example, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission says we can regulate any reactor as long as it's a CANDU. Well, they don't say that as long as it's a CANDU, but they have not regulated a reactor that is not a CANDU. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the same thing. We can regulate any reactor. The only ones they've approved, though, have been light water reactors based on Westinghouse or GE design. So there is a regulation problem. What also relates to that is you need the same sort of regulations for a reactor at 1,200 megawatts as you do at 100. Is it, do you just scale down the regulations, or do you have to keep the regulations the same at all of those? So there's some really interesting questions that's my current project is to investigate those sorts of occasions. The second is civilian prototypes have not really been built. I could show you a sheet of about 25 different companies working on reactors. I've been at many of their presentations around this country, but until they're actually built, you can do a lot with diagrams, you can do a lot with computer analysis, but if I'm buying one, I want to see one. It would be like buying a car and saying, well, here are the blueprints. Can I test drive it? No, but here are the blueprints. No, I want to test drive my car before I buy it. Well, NuScale, which is, in my view, the most advanced of these companies, is currently building that prototype at just off-site at Oregon State University. Those prototypes are critical because then we will get to see them in operation. And the last one I put there is, who wants to be first? There's all sorts of challenges with being first of a kind. And so who wants to take that first leap, even if the prototype is built in Oregon? And in fact, there's an operating reactor in Siberia. But do we want to base ourselves on the Russian regulatory rules? I would suggest not. Putin is not someone I would admire for his knowledge of democracy and scientific evidence and things like that. So while it's operating in Siberia, I want to see something in the West. And who wants to be first? And so the last thing I want to do here before we open up for questions is just to throw out the sort of so what questions. Where are we now? Well, in many cases, this is an old debate that we're having about nuclear energy in Saskatchewan at this moment in time. Many of it are the same issues. Many of the actors are the same. Many of the arguments are the same. You go back to the debates over the CANDU 3. You go back to the debates over the Warman refinery. You go back to the convention and the NDP of 1981 and of 1992. It's not just the same actors. Some of them are the same people and the same arguments. But here is what is new. The issue of climate change. No one was talking about climate change prior to the late 1990s, or it was very small within the scientific community. And so that is a major driver around climate change and the impact of coal production in this province. The political impact of the Fukushima accident, and I would suggest that the political impact is much more important than the actual result of what happened in there. I don't think it's had the same impact as what Three Mile Island and Chernobyl did, but it's still important. And the impact of the Fedoruk Center, where you are developing scientific capacity in this province, and we'll see that play out over the next decade. So that is my presentation. I'll now open it up for questions.